Hello, everybody. Welcome to another week of This Is My Son. I am your host, Kathy Fisher, and with me we have a guest who's been on once before. And my mom was just telling me how much she enjoyed listening to your first episode.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm glad that she liked the episode about the sad dogs.
Yeah, I think she was baffled by the fact that you like the plague dogs.
It's so good, though.
Let's not get into it again. That's a whole another debate to have. Everybody, it's Chris Schock here.
Hi, it's me, Chris Schock from online.
Your friend from online. Everyone's friend.
I love to have fun online.
We all do here at This Is My Son. That's one of the names of the game.
Yes. But it's a game of many names.
So many. And again, I think I should do this at least like once every three episodes. What is the game? Let me describe this game that we're playing right now.
Okay.
The game is that my guest gives me a piece of media that they love unconditionally. I consume that media. I give them a piece of corresponding media, somehow inspired by their piece of media. They consume my piece of media. We'll call this, for shorthand, let's call them sons. And then we get together on a podcast, and we discuss each other's sons, and we rate them on an arbitrary scale. And that's it.
Yeah. Sounds good. Let's actually do it.
Let's do it. Chris, what was your son this week?
This week, for the first time ever, I have brought a book onto This Is My Son.
It's a power move, really.
Yeah, I decided I wanted to do something different. I wanted to stand out. I didn't want to just be a regular person who gives you music or a movie. So I gave you a book. And the book that I picked was You're an Animal, Viscovitz by Alessandro Boffa. This is a book that was given to me like a very long time ago by a friend who I'm still kind of tangentially in contact with. Like I follow her on Twitter. But
it's modern minimal effort friendship.
Yeah, pretty much. Like it's like, oh yeah, she's tweeting, that's great.
Good.
But she sent me this as a birthday gift or something. I was like, what the heck is this? But it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek, just sort of, like, whimsical, but kind of dark at the same time. It's a series of, like, short stories about Viscovitz, who is kind of, like, reincarnated into the forms of different animals and always kind of reliving, like, a similar romance with another creature named Lejuba. And I don't know, it's kind of like fun. It's fun to read. Like I love the way it's written, like the way that he puts the words together just like is really pleasing to me. I think I've done waxing on it for the moment, and I'll let you say something.
So it was interesting. I think the way that I would describe it, too, is it's not only about the relationship between Viscovitz and it's sort of a whole group of fellow mm-hmm. creatures that have the same name, you know, regardless of what species they are. Mm-hmm. But it's like a... It takes the context of like what the mating and sexual rituals are for all the different types of animals, mm-hmm. and then creates a story like fundamentally around like the biology,
yeah,
of them, and establishes like what would it be like, right, to be, I don't know, like a worm, or like, you know,
or a snail,
a praying mantis, or a snail, yeah, or like, you know, a dog or whatever. And it's interesting because I think a lot of them sort of end, they all have a similar tone too, which is, I think it's kind of a cynical worldview.
Oh yeah, definitely. And that's part of why, like, my friend who bought me this bought it for me when I was like 18. So it made a big impact at that time because it coincided very well with my actual worldview at the time.
Just an 18-year-old opinion.
Yeah, I was 18 and very cynical, so.
And, like, there is no true love. Everything, we're all driven by our animal instincts type of thing. Because I feel like that's one of the main themes of this, right?
Oh, yeah. It's like so many of his relationships are sabotaged completely by his animal instincts. And, like, in most of the narratives, he doesn't actually care. Like, he's like, well, yeah, I was in love with her. And then I ate her. The end. You know?
But that's just the way it is. Yeah, because that's normal for that animal's context.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Lejuba is pretty much always portrayed as being, like, not really liking him. You know, at best, she's, you know, like, attracted to him from a, you know, just reproductive sense.
Mm-hmm.
And at worst, she, like, actively hates Viscovitz.
Which, you know, I'm sure that point of view works very well for a lot of young straight men as well.
Yeah. Or, yeah, like, where all women that they want hate them, and it's through no fault of their own, or,
and, like,
through maybe some fault.
The women who like them are tedious and dumpy and boring.
Disgusting, yeah, ugly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which that was maybe the main thing, because I agree, I thought it was, I really liked, I thought it was clever, right?
Yeah.
The constant reframing from each story, and I thought they really, did a good job of reframing or imagining how different animals' perspectives would sort of, like, manifest and when you're sort of personifying them.
Yeah.
A little bit more, or humanizing them. But, like, yeah, it's a male-centric book.
It is very much that.
In a very purely male way, in that it spans many species.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, like, even the stories where, like, he's a creature that doesn't really have a gender, or that changes sexes in its life.
Uh-huh.
Like, even in those contexts, it's still very, like, a masculine point of view.
That's true. Yeah, I'd be curious to see, like, an equivalent, or if, like, half the stories had been more female driven and maybe slightly more, like, positive and less cynical.
Yeah,
because, you know, variety of worldviews.
Yeah, I mean, this is all pretty much the same thing over and over for the most part. There are a couple outliers, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. I think the snail one I liked a lot.
Yeah.
Which is essentially that the snail sees you know, a beautiful vision in the distance, which he perceives to be Lejuba, and decides, yeah, if we both move towards each other as fast as we can, then we can mate before we die. And eventually, when they meet each other, it turns out it's just his own reflection.
Yeah, I love that.
He's outcast by the snail society for having sex with himself.
Yeah, that's like one of the great taboos of snail society, is you cannot have sex with yourself.
Uh-huh. Even though you are asexual or whatever. Like whatever
hermaphroditic,
hermaphroditic animal. Yeah, so, I mean, it's definitely very clever. And I like, you know, each one, I think, read by itself, I would really enjoy. I think it got a little draining reading, like, them one after another, because I read this probably in, like, two sittings.
Yeah, and that's always the way that I've approached it as well. It's like I read it kind of all at once.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, so looking back on it now, I mean, you're saying that you first read it as an 18-year-old, and its worldview definitely resonated with you. How do you think about it now, or how have you changed, do you think, since you first read it?
I've definitely, like, looking at it now, I'm like, yeah, this is a little, like, I don't know if this is too harsh a word, but misogynistic.
Yeah. I mean, in a purely technical sense, right? Kind of.
Yeah, like, there's... I think there's, like, two stories where he kills her.
Uh-huh. Like, and somewhere where she kills him, too.
True, true.
Like, the Praying Mantis one.
Mm-hmm. But that one's short.
It's true, it is short.
But, like, like, the one where he's a police dog, though Lejuba isn't in that one. She's, like, already dead. There's another female dog.
Yeah.
Lana, I think.
Hmm.
And, yeah, it's like, well, it's, he, you know, kills her at the end. And there's the one with the lion and the antelope where he kills her, like...
And eats her, yeah. Yeah, and it's, and the thing is with the lion and antelope one, you can say, oh, yeah, that it was driven by the animal. But for the dog one, yeah, not
the,
really.
The dog one was kind of one of the outliers, I felt like, because it was, like, a hard-boiled... like detective story.
Yeah, it's like a noir story kind of.
Yeah, like the it's the corrupt detective and he's the corrupt detective, you know.
Uh-huh. But also lives in a monastery.
Yep.
It, yeah, that one is weird in that it's very complex. Like whereas a lot of the other ones are very straightforward. It's mm-hmm. just like this is how this animal mates. This is how I think it would work out. If I were this type of animal, right?
Yeah.
Whereas the dog one is like a whole nother thing going on.
Yeah, that one is completely different.
The choo-choo is here.
Yeah, the choo-choo is outside.
Is it here for you?
Yeah, it's coming into the house.
That's pretty cool.
I like that it comes through the house. It's really convenient.
Yeah, if you ever want to get onto the choo-choo, you just grab it.
Yeah, you just hop on.
Hop on, choo-choo time.
Yeah, and you know, I only have to repair my house about 5 times a day.
Easy.
It's easy. It's no problem.
What do you think about animals?
Kathy, this is a loaded question. And you know it.
Like... what would you say if I were to say, like, hey, what about animals? Like, what would you say?
I'd say they're pretty good.
Okay.
I, like, you may have guessed from the media that I've given you before, but I do indeed like stories about animals.
Do you say, like, how would you describe that affinity? Like, what do you think is the source of it?
The source of it?
Not me, not the source, but like, what is it about animals that you find, you know, so engaging?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they're cute.
That's true. Most of them.
Most of them. Some of them are hideous, but I'm also interested in those.
Yeah.
So I guess it's not the cuteness. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's just the appeal of, like, seeing the world through an entirely different worldview.
Mm-hmm.
Like, being able to look at the world from the perspective of, you know, a creature that its brain is basically alien.
Uh-huh.
Like,
yeah, I mean, that's sort of...
Oh, go ahead.
I mean, that's what I was thinking as you were, right before you said it, right? It's, like, similar to thinking, you know, alien societies, mm-hmm. how would they work, or how you think, because, and we don't really maybe consider animals in the same way, but, you know, they are effectively an alien species compared to humans, but they happen to live in the same planet, but we sort of take them for granted.
Yeah, we kind of assume that, you know, animals, if we could go inside their heads, that they would be like, well, their motivations are comprehensible, at least, from our point of view, like, even if we wouldn't agree with them.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's like, oh, you see, you know, another animal of your species, and, like, it's ready to mate. Well, you might just spontaneously go and do that because you have no cultural restrictions on doing that, you know?
Uh-huh.
But,
yeah, I think that is one of the interesting things about this book is it doesn't, I mean, it does have some elements of, like, putting human thoughts or society type things onto it, but also mm-hmm. just like exposes, yeah, this is completely different. Like, I don't know, like the one about sponges.
Yeah.
Is it sponges, right? Where it's just like, yeah, I put my spermatozoa into the water, and because the currents were going a certain way, I had some kids, and then I had some kids with my daughter. And I also had some kids with my uncle and my grandparents.
Yep.
And that's just the way it is.
Or it's like, yeah, it's I produced children with my own mother, you know. And then, like, the water current switches, and it's like, oh no, my sex changed just as the current switches, and now they're all impregnating me.
Yep.
Yeah, I love that combination of, like, it's, like, kind of heavy-duty anthropomorphism in some cases, where it is like, oh yeah, I'm, like, the snails have a society where it is verboten to have sex with yourself. Uh-huh. And, you know, it's like, oh yeah, the snails are still in contact with their parents and stuff like that, which, you know, like, that is anthropomorphism as well.
Yeah.
But then they combine that with, like, just the hard biological facts. And I actually like how he, he actually uses, like, you know, the $10 science words, you know?
Yeah, for the very specific, like, reproductive organs and things like that are
mm-hmm.
features of these animals.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, I guess maybe if I'd had an annotated version, like, right where it has a diagram of every animal. Because, like, right, I don't, you know, reading this, I'm like, yeah, you put your, you know, X into the air to sense your blahs or something like, I don't know offhand without looking stuff up what is actually happening.
Yeah, I get that. And at the same time, though, like, I feel like that actually works. Like, it is kind of that sort of, like, tongue-in-cheek view of, like, an alien society. So, like, it's like, I don't really need to know what that is in order to kind of visualize this little creature, like, waving its antenna in the air or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
And, it's just kind of fun to read. Mm-hmm. I enjoy it.
Yeah, I agree. I think it for, you know, quick, pleasurable, entertaining reading, it's very good.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, the entire book is not very long, so you really can, and each of the short stories is short enough that it's, you know, maybe, like, maximum 5-ish, 10-ish minutes to read one.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a pretty quick read. Like, it's, like, even the general content of each story is just pretty light and moves along pretty quickly.
Uh-huh. And so, maybe we should talk, too, about the final story, which I found was one of my favorites.
Was that the bacterium one?
Yeah, it's sort of the start of basically multi-celled organisms.
Mm-hmm.
Which I found really... I mean, there's definitely... It's informed a lot by science.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically not really talking as much... You don't have, like, the Lejuba element, because it's like we're all single-celled organisms, we just reproduce by splitting. And he basically has a conversation with God.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Lejuba is actually there.
Is she? Or she's just a fellow bacterium?
She's a fellow cell.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have the book next to me. So I'm...
I got it on Kindle, so I can't easily flip through it.
Well, at the very end, this is how I invented sex. It may have been a little clumsy, but my heart had been in it, and this was meant literally, because the cell that was his heart actually, like, went into her.
Uh-huh.
I asked the gelatin how it had been for her. That's sex? She burst out laughing, quivering all over. You call that sex? Still roaring with laughter, she contracted her siphon and took off without a backward glance, leaving me there with my heart in pieces. Yeah, this... go ahead.
Oh, yeah, just at the end of that story is also where they introduce death, too, which is another sort of, you know, thematic mm-hmm. thing in the book of sex and death and, you know, the cycle of life in general.
Yeah.
Which makes it a little bittersweet.
Yeah, I like that, though.
In a very straightforward way.
Yeah, I mean, it is very straightforwardly dealing with, like, these, yeah, fundamental facts of life. It's like, yeah, you're born, you fuck, you die. The end.
Yep. And everyone does it.
Everyone does it.
All life across the planet. Fundamentally, it's all the same. And that's, I guess, another thing, right, is by having the same characters in every context, mm-hmm. it's basically, like, all life is effectively the same. We may have our own, like, various rituals and different biological facts, but really it's all the same.
Yep. I guess I still do kind of agree with that on some level.
Yeah.
Where it's like, yeah, you know, like, life has value. Human life has value. But animal life has value, too.
And no life actually has that much value.
Yeah, I mean, it's all more or less the same. Like, we're all following the same urges. We're not particularly better than, you know, like, apes in the forest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like we figured some other things out that they haven't yet. That's pretty much it. Like, yeah. You know, skyscrapers and choo-choos.
Choo-choos, and we can write books about how we think they might be.
Yeah, and they can't do that. And apes cannot get online.
It's true, and it's one of the main problems that I find with ape society.
Yeah, I've heard that dolphins can get online.
Yeah.
With some assistance. Yeah, I saw that octopi. Mm-hmm.
They log on all the time.
Yeah, oh yeah. I think like 50% of people online are octopi.
That actually makes a lot of sense.
They have difficulty typing. Like, they have a lot of tentacles, but they're a little clumsy.
There are a lot of Twitter personalities that I think might be octopi.
Yeah?
Yeah, just in terms of just sloppy typing technique, you know?
Mm-hmm. Like, maybe, like, most Twitter, like, advertising bots are just actually octopi that were hired. It's cheap to hire an octopus.
What do you have to pay an octopus in?
Like, shellfish, probably.
Okay.
So that's, like, you know, it could be a little expensive depending on what
you get. It could, yeah. I mean, geez, shellfish, yeah, depending on the season, too.
But, you know, they don't eat that much of it, so it's maybe not as big a deal.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it just depends on how many you need to employ.
Yeah, if you have, like, 100 tanks of octopus in your office, that probably has costs besides paying the octopus.
I assume so. And getting all those waterproof computers is the hard part.
Yeah, that's the hard part. You know, you could try with other animals in the water if you're going to spend that much money.
Well, you just assume you can put a lot of ocean life in there with the computers and you just see who shows an affinity for it.
Yeah, you find out who's good at it just by... You put a keyboard in there and you're like, well, go to town.
Who's composed the most viral tweets?
And
you can just see, look at their stats.
Yeah. Yeah, and you can, you know, like the fish, you know, fish are not that smart, but fish will compose tweets by accident.
Like, at least 30% of tweets are accidental tweets composed by fish.
It's true. It's just a simple fact, Kathy.
I know, and it's just so great that I know it.
So the role of humans is really... to just get other animals online.
Uh-huh. That's how I see it. I mean, that's how I see my personal job in life.
You go down the street, you see a cat walking around, you just hand them your iPhone. You're like, man, you have to get online.
Uh-huh. Get online, please. I'm begging you to get online.
Please, for God's sake, get online.
We need more cats.
We need every warm body on this planet to get online.
If we could just get every mammal online, do you know how much we'd enhance the whole experience?
Of online?
Of online.
Oh. I can only imagine how great online would become. And then we could start working on getting the bees online.
Well, I feel like bees are like a whole different thing because they work as a hive, right?
Yes, but one hive could produce so much content.
That's true. I mean, that's like, oh, BuzzFeed.
Oh, yeah.
Is that what that is?
Yeah, it's bees.
Because I've always wondered who is it who actually contributes to BuzzFeed, and now I think I know.
I think it is, you know, there's a few hives. Some of them are wasps and some of them are bees.
How do I tell the difference?
I guess the quality of the content.
Yeah. Are bees better at it or wasps?
You know, I think the wasps are better at getting you to click.
But the they bees don't have the staying power.
Yeah, they don't have the staying power. The bees have better content.
Okay. Okay.
But both are valuable.
You know, it's all becoming clear for me now.
I'm glad. I'm glad I was able to clarify how content is produced online.
I think I'm ready to rate now that I understand.
Okay. So what's your scale going to be?
I'm going to rate it on a scale of 1 to 5 octopus computers.
Okay.
And I am going to give it a solid 4.
Nice.
Which is a good one.
I think 4 out of 5 is usually one of the good numbers.
It's definitely up there.
Mm-hmm.
I do wish, the only reason that's given it markdowns is that it's still too cynical and a little too dude-centric, you know?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that viewpoint after rereading it as a fully grown adult who has to live life as a woman. Yeah, I definitely noticed, like, oh yeah, this is, like, it's not only dude-centric, it's misogynistic.
Yeah.
But I still like it.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's clever and well-written, so... That's why it's up there.
Mm-hmm. All right, so are we switching gears?
Yeah, let's do it.
To boy number 2?
I'm going to take a sip of Dr. Pepster.
A little pepler?
Dr. Pep Pep.
You're getting pepped. You got pepped.
Get pep up. It's Dr. Peps.
Get pepped. You need to get pepped. Get your pep smear.
Oh, God. Every year, get a pep smear.
You just...
Step one of women's health.
Yeah, just put some Dr. Pepper in there. That's all ask you.
I don't know if the gynecologist I go to is, like, licensed.
She just takes the bottle, opens it, and kind of puts it in there.
Yeah, she shakes it up. She puts her thumb over the top and shakes it up a few times. And then she gives me a blast. Downstairs.
Oh, God.
Chris, this week, I, in response,
mm-hmm.
gave you a son that is also a word-style book that I treasure.
Mm-hmm.
And that son is... The Master and Margarita,
mm-hmm.
the very famous, well-regarded Mikhail Bulgakov novel. I don't know how to pronounce Russian, so I'm just winging it.
That sounds fine.
Okay. And it is a novel about the devil and kind of about Pontius Pilate. Kind of a satire of Soviet culture. It's a lot of things all rolled into one.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of a Faust story, also.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of about a talking cat that walks around on two legs.
I like that part.
Yeah, everyone does. Everyone loves Behemoth.
He's fun.
He's very fun. But it's also very... yeah, it sort of covers a lot of ground. It's a comedic, but also tragic, and also satirical and political, and it's got a lot of stuff. It contains multitudes.
Yeah, that I had read this before, but it had been a while, so I read it again. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the first thing I noticed was that we don't get to the titular characters until we're like over halfway through the book.
Yeah, it takes a long time.
Like, there's a whole lot of just like, I assume it's lampooning the literary scene in Moscow in the 30s, but like, I wasn't in Moscow in the 30s and don't really know what it was like, so for all I know, this is 100% realistic.
It's as ridiculous as it is all described.
Yeah, like, there's, like, this fancy restaurant and, like, just, like, a world of lunatics who will hire just about anyone. Like, you have, like, some lunatic magician who comes into town. You're just like, yeah, sure. And people, well, yeah, the people disappearing, I know, is, like, a reference to people being sent to gulags, but...
Yeah. And I would say, I don't know that they would hire anyone. I think that Woland, who is the devil figure, mm-hmm. who comes in basically in the guise of a magician doing a black magic show...
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure that they would not, if they were not being influenced by Satan, would not have hired him to do a magic show.
I don't know if that's 100% clear that they wouldn't have.
Well, none of them remember actually signing the documents.
That's true, that, yeah.
Like, be like, yeah, we'll sign a contract to have you perform. They just sort of appeared, and he's like, yep, so my show tomorrow night is gonna happen.
And then people are like, hey, wait a minute. And he's like, okay, you're leaving now. Goodbye.
Yeah, why don't you go to Yalta?
Why not?
Spontaneously. Why not?
Like, who would stop you?
Yeah, so, I mean, it was, you know, at the time when it was written, which was over a fairly long span of time,
mm-hmm.
during which, like, Bulgakov, you know, did burn his manuscript and have to start over because he was, you know, went through a lot of ups and downs with his relationship with, like, Stalin and stuff, which is hard. It's real hard.
It's real hard to maintain a relationship with Stalin.
It really is. And it wasn't actually, like, published in Russia until the 60s, and yeah. Even so in a censored version, highly censored.
Like, what did they take out of it? That's...
Yeah, so when I first read this book, I was taking a class in college about Faust and about various Faust adaptations.
Mm-hmm.
Through time. And part of it, when we got to this, which was the last novel we studied, we got to look at some of the basically excerpts from that original censored version.
Yeah.
And I think the startling thing is, like, they left a lot in. Like, certainly probably took out some of the more pointed satire, but, like, that whole scene where Woland is doing his black magic
mm-hmm.
show... Which you imagine, like, he's, like, you know, staring out at the audience is like, do you think Muscovites are different? Like,
yeah.
And, like, there's a lot of very, very pointed, pretty obvious, like, yeah, the current political system is fucked stuff going on. And they mm-hmm. left it in. Like, they left a lot of it in.
Yeah, that is really surprising to me. Though, the fact that it was published, like, 30 years after... he had originally written it,
mm-hmm.
like, kind of says to me that, like, maybe some of the edge had already kind of worn off in the minds of many people, so it just didn't seem as inflammatory as it would have, like, earlier in the nation's history.
Yeah, and I wonder, I mean, I'm no Soviet Russia expert, but I wonder if it was, like, in the 60s, in a post- Stalin time where they're like, well, we're totally different than what it was like back then
mm-hmm.
type of situation where they were willing to decry probably a lot of the more grievous atrocities that Stalin did.
Like the murders of millions of yeah, people.
Like the murders. Like a lot of genocide type yeah. of stuff.
Yeah. So that like they're willing to say that was bad at least.
Yeah. And so they're like, well, this novel was just, you know, was negative about that, but now we're better.
And now we're fine.
Now, yeah, the Soviet Russia in the 60s was fine and nice to live in. It was a good place.
Well, you know, they made good cartoons.
That's true.
In the 60s in Russia, like, all the cartoons were good. It's kind of insane. Like,
yeah. And they, it's interesting because this novel is like super, super popular and like very, very well known and famous in Russia.
Yeah.
And like they have, like there are statues of Behemoth the cat.
Wow.
In various places. which is just, it's so great because it's such a, I feel like in America this would never be like a big mainstream hit because it's so esoteric. Like it's so weird.
Yeah, it's like reading it because I am also not a Soviet history expert. Yeah, some of it definitely went over my head where it's like, I'm sure this is a satire of something.
So did you have an annotated edition?
No, I didn't. I just grabbed one from the library.
Yeah, because that definitely helps, at least with a lot of the really specific references where you can get, and like when he's doing some sort of allusion to some other work.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely helpful to have some sort of more intelligent person who went through and wrote it down for you.
Or someone who at least has education.
The cultural knowledge.
The cultural background of it. Because, yeah, I don't have that. I still found it very, both fun and stressful to read. Like, I feel like the first half, like, before it really gets rolling is just, like, it's just a sequence of scenes in which Boland is either killing people or, like transporting them far away from their homes and no one knows where they went.
Or just otherwise ruining their lives.
Just ruining their lives straight up. Yeah.
Like putting foreign currency in their house and stuff like that.
Getting them arrested by the authorities. Not even sending them away himself or killing them himself. It's just...
Uh-huh.
It's like, we'll get you in trouble with the law where they will either exile or kill you.
Yeah. So, yeah, and I think that entire first half is definitely more steeped in satire.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it does feel like, especially... the first time you read it, like an endless series of just random Russian people.
Yeah.
Random Russian dudes with like bad stuff befalling them.
When I first read it, I could not keep the name straight.
Mm-hmm.
I think I did a better job this time.
I think that the key is you have to read it once to figure out whose name you don't really care about remembering versus whose name you actually have to know.
Yeah. And, yeah, it's like by the second half, all the names you tried to remember from the first half, of which there are many, almost all of them are no longer relevant.
Yeah, you don't really need to know about any of them anymore. They briefly harken back to some of them near the end. But, at that point, you really cared more about the whole plot with the titular Master and Margarita.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering, so the other half, and we've sort of touched on the Soviet satire half, but the other half is a pretty heavily sort of like religious and also sort of about the nature of art and expression and I think femininity in a lot of ways. And I was wondering what you thought about that.
Yeah, I like the whole story about like the witches and going to like the witches' ball. And it's funny how life as a witch, as like Satan's servant, is infinitely preferable to any of the other options available to the women in the story.
Yeah, pretty much.
Because it's like, well, you could stay a maid for the rest of your life, or if you're Margarita, you can go home and like basically commit suicide. Or you could become Satan's servant and live
and
out
be
your
nude
life.
And fly nude. Around.
Yeah. why would you go back home and commit suicide when you could go to Satan's parties naked?
Uh-huh. Yeah. And I like that her servant chooses to stay a witch rather than go back definitely. I always find that whole section of the book where, you know, Margarita gets the magic cream from Azazello and becomes a witch briefly. I find it really like exhilarating and fun, and it's a lift because, like, you know, the entire novel up to then has been about how restricted and how much, you know, horrible disappointment and stuff there is in that life, and then all of a sudden Margarita is like completely released from all of her chains of like both feeling obligated to her husband and you know, her normal staid life, and is given like infinite power basically.
Yeah, like the first thing she does is like fly around breaking the windows of people she doesn't like.
Uh-huh, it's great.
It's like, I'm invisible and I can fly? Well, this is the obvious choice.
Yeah, I'm just gonna fuck this guy's shit up.
Even like Satan's Ball, where she does have obligations, like, it still feels like, it's like, yes, I have so much power, and my obligation is really just in, you know, like, being helpful. Like, she actually, like, gets Satan to stop tormenting, like, one specific woman who, like, drowned her baby. Or, like, abandoned it.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, definitely harkening back to, I don't know, have you ever read Goethe's Faust?
No, I haven't.
Well, so one of the Gretchen Margarita, the equivalent Margarita character in that is basically like a young girl who gets seduced by Faust and gets pregnant and then kills her child because she can't, you know, she's out of,
she can't take care of a child out of
wedlock. Yeah. And can't take care of it. And then gets executed for her crime at the end. So that, I think, was specifically what that was supposed to be referencing.
Yeah.
But it's great because, I mean, in a lot of ways, too, that Satan's various attendants, specifically, like, Behemoth and Azazello and...
Karoviev.
The whole gang.
Yeah.
Karoviev, yeah. They all are, like, so supportive and helpful.
Yeah, which is like, weird from... Like, in the first half of the book, they are kind of straightforward demons. Like, they just mess with people and just, like, on whims, do things to upset people or hurt them.
But those people are bad.
Yeah, like, that, it's funny. Like, in the second half of the book, when they meet up with Margarita, they're, like, they're helpful and, like, kind to her. Like, Azazello, who's, like, the scariest one, is just, like, very sweet to her, almost. Like...
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's great, because they set up these characters who are, you know, extremely powerful and can be extremely malicious. And, you know, part of Margarita's, you know, cool package of becoming a witch is she gets preferential treatment as, you know, basically Satan's hostess for this big party.
Oh, yeah, and that, like, Karoviev, like, very, like, gallantly walks her around the party, and...
Yeah, it's... I don't know, yeah, I really love that whole section where it's like, yeah, the devil's pretty cool. He's a cool dude.
It's like, yeah, if you're cool to the devil, he'll be cool to you. Like...
Yeah, like, if you're not, like, greedy and vain and, you know, mean and stupid...
Yeah, and that's,
the devil's down.
That's kind of the peculiar thing, is, like, the people who, like, consider themselves just normal folks are the real sinners, whereas the people who make deals with Satan are, maybe they're still sinners, but at least, you know, they accept that they're sinners.
And they're striving for something more,
they're
right?
Striving for something more in their life, yeah. Something more than money and, I don't know, getting laid.
So one of the themes that is pretty prominent is like the idea of like cowardice being a big sin, and that's probably, you know, where one of the things is, right? People who are afraid and selfish are punished, whereas Margarita's fearless, basically, because she's, like, beyond caring about what happens to her. And so she is empowered, and eventually she and the master are, you know, reunited, and she really saves him. She's the hero.
She saves him,
in the story.
Yeah,
he is, like, you know, given up, is in an insane asylum, and, you know, burned all of his work and all that stuff, but she both believes in his genius as a writer and him, and rescues him, basically. I've always been intrigued by the way that Jesus and Pontius Pilate are depicted.
Yeah, I love the little sub novel that is the Pontius Pilate and Christ story, because it is kind of odd in that it effectively is saying, you know, everything in the Bible was made up by this one guy who, like, followed Jesus around and then, like, made shit up to, like, enhance the story and make people kind of join up. You know, it's, like, exaggerating what Jesus was really about. Like, the Christ in this story is, like, he doesn't, like, he's not even really preaching to people. Like, he's just going around and being a cool dude.
Yeah, he's just being a nice guy, essentially. Yeah, and it's sort of implied that, like, yes, he is holy and potentially, you know, he's godly, you know, so at the end, Pontius Pilate does walk up his moonbeam path to talk with Jesus. And it's still like, yeah, this guy has definitely got some God elements at the very least, but it's without the all of the trappings of Christianity that you'd normally associate with it.
Yeah, like, all of the dogma is pretty much dismissed as being wrong.
Yeah. Or as being, like, not even relevant, right? Not that it was incorrect or that there's a different dogma, but just that there is no dogma,
there is no dogma. It's just, you know, Christ, yeah, it's like he's just, like, a wise man with some kind of supernatural power.
He's just a chill guy who likes everybody. He thinks everybody's good.
Yeah, and, like, he's preaching a radical message that, like, basically no one is, like, worthy of punishment. Which is, like, the only thing that they really kept from, like, the Christian message that we're kind of exposed to as modern Western people. Like, I don't really know what the Russian Orthodoxy is like.
I have to assume it's at least somewhat similar.
It's probably, it's probably closer to Catholicism, would be my guess. Like, they split off earlier.
Yeah.
But, I really enjoyed the Christ and Pilate thing. And, like, at the end when, like, Volan basically implies, like, like, he is in contact with Jesus, and they're kind of bros.
Well, yeah, they're chatting, and they come to a decision together, like, yeah, the Master and Margarita don't deserve to go to heaven necessarily, they're just gonna have some peace.
Yeah.
Just live in peace forever.
Yeah, and I don't know if it even implies that there is a heaven, or a hell, really, because, like, yeah, Satan's ball is just, like, you call up dead sinners to party.
Yeah, and they just appear in their coffin.
Yeah, they, like, their coffin just busts out of the ground, and they hop out, and the flesh goes back onto them.
Yeah, I mean, I find the sort of idea of a classic Western monotheistic system that's sort of pushed in this, or is described, to be my favorite one of all of them, basically.
Yeah.
Of basically, like, yeah, Satan, you know, he does actually literally kill the Master and Margarita.
Yeah,
but
actually,
you know, it's no big deal.
In the version I have, at least, it's like Azazello gives them the poisoned wine that kills them, And when he kills them, it's like they never left the places where they were. Like, like she dies in her husband's apartment, and the master dies in his room in the mental ward.
Insane asylum. Yeah.
But then later, like at the very end, it's described that they had just vanished.
Yeah, it's unclear.
So, yeah, it's like, I'm not sure, like, are there two realities at play here? Though, yeah, almost definitely.
Yeah, I mean, it's another thing that I'm wondering if that, where that, because I noticed that when I read it this time, too, that this wasn't actually ever fully published or fully finished while Bulgakov was alive. So it was finished from, like, using all the bits and pieces of various editions and manuscripts he'd had, so I don't know if he'd fully decided whether or not it had been real or just been, like, in their minds.
Yeah, like, up to the point where, Azazello kills them, I kind of took it to be, like, oh yeah, it's 100% real. Like, I have no reason to believe it's not, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, at the very end also, like, when they're riding, like, this is kind of a tangent, but, like, when they're riding the horses away to, like, this peaceful place where the master and Margarita will live out their days, like, when the glamour falls away from everyone, and, like, it's revealed... Like, I'm not entirely sure of the significance of some of them, if they're, like, references to other things or not. Like, Koroviev was actually, like, a very somber knight who was condemned for, like, playing a practical joke.
Yeah, I don't know. I at least read that the fact that he is described as an ex-choirmaster was implied that maybe he was, like, in the angelic choir before he fell or something like that. But I don't know if there's any more specific reference that he's... any more specific potential angel that he might be referencing? I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, and, like, Behemoth was, like, a young squire. And it's like, I'm trying to figure out, like, who these... who these... like, are these references to another literary work is what I'm trying to figure out.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, so for Faust specifically, right, there's really only one, like, Mephistopheles is technically the embodiment of the devil that's in it, which isn't really the devil proper. But he's definitely more of a trickster, jokester.
Yeah.
Demon, which I always sort of line that up with Behemoth a little bit more, even though, so they mentioned a couple times, like, Margarita has, like, a locket with a picture of a black poodle in it.
Yeah.
And that's how Mephisto originally appears in Faust.
Ah.
So it's sort of implying, like, I don't know, you know, obviously the devil has a lot of faces or embodiments, but it's unclear to me who all everyone is supposed to really represent in this.
Well, except Azazello is definitely, like, the angel of death.
Yeah. Yeah. Or is Abaddon the angel of death, and Azazello is Azazel, who's just another demon-y type.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, yeah, some of them are more clearly, like, oh, I know who this is supposed to be, and then some of them are a little bit vaguer.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like, just based on the way they described Koroviev, that he is supposed to be someone specific. I was hoping you knew.
yeah, I don't know, I think you'd have to
read the Cliff's Notes.
I'm constantly disappointed in myself, but more so than anything, because the class where we studied this was literally my favorite class from all of college. It was so great.
Yeah.
It was one of those ones where the professor is just, like, full of general knowledge and just, like, talks the entire class and just is, like, fascinating. But I didn't, like, take... If I did take notes, I threw them away at some point, and I definitely didn't, like, record any of the documentation we had for this class, but I really wish I had, because there definitely our analysis of this book was much deeper than anything I remember about it now.
Yeah, I would love to hear that.
Yeah, I kind of want to sneak. I wonder if he's still teaching it. I mean, just like go back to Ann Arbor and sneak into the class.
Just like, yeah, go in for like the few sessions that deal with this book.
Yeah, I assume it's still at the end of the semester. I can figure it out. Or I'll just like look him up online, email him. Can I have all your materials for this class? I really loved it.
It's like, you know, it's been like 7 years, but I really loved your class.
I really loved your class, and I want it to be an audiobook that I can listen to. I wonder, you know, they have all those, like, iTunes U courses. I don't know. I should look deeper into it, because it was just great. And except for the fact that I couldn't finish Thomas Mann's Dr. Faustus, because it was awful.
I'm sorry.
You should be sorry.
I haven't read much Mann myself.
I found it unpleasant.
Yeah. Yeah, he also wrote The Magic Mountain, right? Or am I thinking of the wrong man?
I can't remember.
I'm going to Google. Just to be sure. Important writer Thomas Mann. Yeah, Magic Mountain. I've read Magic Mountain. I actually really liked that.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I haven't read anything else of his, so maybe I just didn't like his interpretation of Faust.
That could be.
It wasn't very Fausty.
I would recommend...
I like Faustier Fausts.
Yeah, I would recommend Magic Mountain. Just...
Yeah?
Yeah, if you feel like reading another book sometime soon.
I don't know. Books, man.
You know? It's, you know, it takes up some of your time, but it's very fulfilling.
That's true. I feel very scholarly when I read.
Me too, even though I, did not, I felt like much of this book still went over my head, and I would like to maybe find out more about, both about Faust, which I don't think I've ever read any version of Faust. Like, it's like there was like a Wishbone episode.
Wishbone's Faust? That must be the grimmest Wishbone ever.
Yeah, you know, Wishbone's Faust.
Yeah, I mean, the reason why Faust is great, and the reason especially why this class that was about is great, is that the history of Faust is essentially, like, the history of, like, the concept of, like, magic in Western history. Because it pulls on all of these, like, very, very old mythoses and legends and figures.
Yeah.
Of, like, this, the doctor figure who's, you know, striving for knowledge, basically, and gets punished for it.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of I guess it's a classic thing that probably comes from Faust.
But... Yeah. But, yeah, so it's great, it's very interesting. I definitely would recommend Goethe's Faust 1. Faust 2 is tough.
Yeah.
But Faust 1 is a pretty quick read.
Okay.
And if you want to read it in German, you can do that, too.
I don't think I am capable of doing that at this time.
You could just learn German.
I could. I have been learning French, and I can't even read children's books, so...
Yeah, I read it in German. I didn't fully understand it until I then read it in English afterwards. So. But, yeah, then there's also pretty nifty... German, like, I think it was, like, a TV recorded, like, video recorded play.
Yeah.
By this guy who was really famous, or the guy who played Mephisto was really famous in Germany for playing Mephisto. Like, he was Hitler's favorite Mephisto.
Oh, God.
We watched this in German class.
That is a hell of a title to give a man.
And there's also a movie about the actor called Mephisto.
I think I've heard of that.
Yeah. Anyways, but I watched a version of it where he is playing it as, like, a 70-year-old man. But anyways.
Nice.
Digression. Chris, would you like to rate
My Son? I'm going to rate this on a scale of cats with guns.
Okay.
I give The Master and Margarita 5 out of 5. Cats with Guns.
Oh my god, that's a perfect score. I don't know if we've gotten a perfect score before.
I really like this book. I should own a version of this. Like, I got it from the library. Like, I need to buy it. Like, it really, like, I don't know. The first half is kind of tough, but I really, really, really like the second half. Mm-hmm. And I like all the Pontius Pilate stuff. And I, like, when I picked it up to read it for this session, I picked it up around Easter, which was kind of, like, a perfect time.
Because that's when it's set. Yeah.
Yeah, and I have, like, kind of a, I don't know, a conflicted view of Christianity at this point. Like, I was raised religious and am not anymore. So, mm-hmm. Like, the religious stuff definitely, like, got me. And got kind of the, it's like the view I would like to have from Christianity.
Yeah, that's how I feel about it too, as another similarly raised Christian, not very actively religious now person.
Mm-hmm.
This is sort of my idealized, Christianity, which is sort of perverse in that I like the idea of the devil, like, just hanging out on earth and making annoying people suffer.
Yeah.
But also that I get to be a witch and fly around.
I like that.
But I'm still cool.
Yeah, Jesus still loves you, even if you're a witch who flies around breaking your neighbor's windows.
It's the perfect world.
That's the lesson I learned.
Uh-huh. All right, well, this is pretty momentous. I'm going to have to process this 5 out of 5.
It's good.
Yeah, I'm very happy.
So would you recommend, a specific edition of this book that would be better for me to read that would help me understand the historical stuff that I don't understand?
So I have the Penguin Books one, which is I can't remember. I'm going to look up which translation it is. I'm not sure which one I think it might have been the same one I read for the class, but I don't know because I lent it to my mom and then she like really messed up my paperback, so I made her buy me a new one.
Like there are 4 or 5 different editions of this, and I don't know which ones are supposed to be the good ones or not.
Yeah, so the one. Okay, this is the one. Oh, man, it is. So, yeah, I've read 2 different translations of this. So the one I read for the class, which maybe you could say, I guess my professor vouched for it,
mm-hmm.
was the 1996 paperback by Bergen, translated by Bergen and Tiernan O'Connor.
Okay.
And the one that I just read, which has good notes, is the Penguin Classics one. Translated by Pivier and Volokonsky.
So the Penguin Classics one is the one you have now.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think they're both good. I don't know about the subtle differences, though, in between them, because I'm sure they're slightly different.
Yeah, the version that I read for this one was Michael Glennie.
Hmm.
It's the one that has Behemoth holding a gun on the cover.
Nice.
Which is very appealing.
Yeah, there are a lot of these. There's also a 50th anniversary edition. I wonder if that has even more annotations.
Yeah, or is it just like hardcover? Like, this looks like it's the same translation as the Penguin one.
Yeah, oh, and it's got illustrations. Maybe that's the difference.
Actually, that's what I want. I want illustrations.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a pre-order. It's not even out yet. It's out next week.
Whoa, shit. I timed this so well.
This is perfect. We can now plug the 50th anniversary edition of The Master and Margarita.
Yeah, this whole thing was a sponsored episode, and we're getting paid by Penguin Books to publicize their new edition, new 50th anniversary edition of The Master and Margarita. It's coming out next week. Buy it today. Pre-order today.
Yeah.
It's got illustrations.
It's got illustrations, and the cover looks really cool.
Yeah, it does. is there anything else beyond this, which we're definitely being paid for? Anything else you'd like to plug?
I'm trying to think. Well, I recently put on online the zine that I put out late last year about rock and roll. With a bunch of friends. Rock and roll is something, I don't remember if I've ever made you watch it.
You haven't, actually. I've escaped it so
far.
Kathy,
I have a new son for you. yeah, it's this zine that I put out with a group of artists from online. And it's fantastic, and I think it's really wonderful if you are familiar with rock and roll. And if you're not, you could watch Rock and Roll and then get the zine for free online. And the website is wolfteeth.itch.io. And you can click it on there and it will come right up and you can download the PDF and look at these comics and pictures and read my essay about the history of rock and roll to get pumped about rock and roll.
Chris, would you say that this is like the the preeminent source of academic knowledge for rock and roll?
Yeah, probably. I don't know if anyone is citing it in academic journals, but they should.
any kind of rock and roll scholar that's out there, this is a must have.
Yes. It's fantastic. And, we also, my spouse, Mouse, and I created a new Tumblr blog with some illustrations from a zine we put out. This is not safe for work. It is for grown-ups only.
Because NSFW.
It's NSFW. It is not for the children to view because there are little mouse dranguses.
It's got dongles in it. It's got peeps.
It's got little mouse peeps all over. It's called Mice Making Love. And this was like a poetry and illustration zine we did about sex. So, yeah, if you like to be horny and look at cartoon mice, micemakinglove.tumblr.com is where you can go and do that.
Nice. And where can we follow you on Twitter?
You can follow me on Twitter at Krishva, that's K-R-I-S-H-V-A, where you can read about my life and things that I'm doing and things that make me sad.
It's just her online log of what her activities are on the net.
Yeah, it's just me talking about what I'm doing on the line, on the net.
It's beautiful. And you can follow what I'm doing on the net and online at MySocks, M-I-S-O-K-S. And you can follow this podcast at This Is My Son or thisismyson.com or subscribe on iTunes and please give us a rating. Even if you just do a little star click start, just click the five stars.
Give us five. Give us 5 out of 5 cats with guns.
Yeah, and specifically ask iTunes if they can implement a cats with guns rating system because then we'll know relative to the Master Margarita how good it is.
Yeah. It's a good podcast, I have to say. I give it 5 stars.
As a current guest, I think it's a good podcast.
As a current guest, I'm rating the episode I'm on right now 5 stars. This is a good one.